Conclusions. 10 questions about art and crime. Naturally, many stories remain untold at the end of this book, and many questions are left unanswered. Even as we prepared to go to press, spectacular news from the world of art and crime continued to arrive. At the end of November 2019, the treasure vaults of the City Palace, the so-called Museum Grünes Gewölbe, or Green Vault Museum in Dresden, Germany, were broken into, and 3 pieces of 18th-century jewelry, which were extremely valuable, not just for the gold used and the thousands of diamonds, brilliants, and precious stones set in them, but because of their historical significance, were stolen. In Gotha, Germany, 5 old master paintings were returned that had been stolen in 1979. The Italian Carabinieri arrested 23 people whom the criminal authorities accuse of forming an illegal organization that damaged the cultural heritage of the nation by trading in illegally excavated cultural artifacts throughout Europe. The items that had been dug up to be sold in Europe included vases and oil lamps, jewelry and coins, buckles and jugs. More than 10,000 objects were seized. Locations were also searched in England, France, Serbia, and Germany. As reflected in a conversation between 2 of the participants that was recorded during surveillance, it was said with respect to one excavation site in the Calabrian Paludi, "The valley has been completely dug up. Next is Paludi. Paludi, too, should disappear from the postcards." They discussed their finds using code words such as white truffle, salami, or asparagus. According to investigators, the conspiracy is presumably linked to a mafia clan. There is no date yet for the trial. At the same time, an appellate court in Lyon affirmed the judgment against Pablo Picasso's former electrician and the handyman's wife. In 2015 and 2016, respectively, they were given a 2-year suspended sentence for misappropriating 271 works by the Spanish artist that they stored for years in their garage. Ironically, the electrician first came to the artist's house in the early 1970s to install an alarm system. When the couple sought to obtain certificates of authenticity from Picasso's son Claude in September 2010 for unsigned works, he became suspicious and lodged a complaint. Before the court, the electrician and his wife spoke of a wondrous gift that they had received from Picasso's second and last wife, Jacqueline. They testified that after the artist's death, she asked the couple to take the drawings and other works that were packed in garbage bags. From the years 1900 to 1932, with an estimated value of 60 million euros. They said that she had told them there were problems with Claude, the artist's son from his first marriage. A collector living in Bremen, Germany, complained that 342 pieces from her collection had disappeared in China. She had made the pictures and sculptures available to a company in Hamburg, Germany, which exhibited them with the assistance of German curators in Beijing, Shanghai, and Wuhan, and, with the consent of the owner, offered them for sale. Anselm Kiefer, one of the artists affected, along with Markus Lupertz, had already objected in 2017 to the project, which he said had taken place without his agreement. The exhibiting firm no longer exists. Its former owner responded to the accusations of fraud by alleging that, to the contrary, the oral agreement for the loan was for 10 years. It is said that 300 million euros is at stake, though there is no proof of the assertion, and also that the Chinese authorities have still not responded to the criminal charges which were brought in July 2019. The story remains to be told of a prominent Berlin gallerist who was arrested in the fall of 2019 because he was alleged to have engaged in fraud in art transactions. Supposedly, it's a matter of millions of euros. And, even apart from the investigations that led to the arrest, a collector who had been a customer of the gallery found that, instead of the original by Gerhard Richter that the gallerist had exhibited in 2014, he had in his possession an almost identical copy that the head of the artist's archives judged to be a fraud. It is still not clear who made the copy and who put it in circulation. The collector is said to have gotten a receipt that featured a photograph of the genuine work at the time the piece was transferred into his possession. Other collectors and business partners of the dealer, meanwhile, have made other accusations. The inquiries sent several times to the person under suspicion, who operated temporary branch offices in the Far East, and once referred to artworks as shares of stock, received no response. The presumption of innocence applies to him. Back in Florida, a German company that specializes in the financing of art acquisitions filed a complaint in fall 2019 against a different gallerist, who was active in Miami and London. At issue is the alleged illegal conversion of contemporary art worth several million dollars. Even the search for the art to grace the cover of this book led, accidentally, to evidence of a possible forgery. The dollar sign by Andy Warhol that was originally selected and was being offered for sale in an American internet auction caused consternation at the Warhol Foundation, which administers the rights of the artist. This motif was unknown, they said. Most likely, it's a forgery. The dollar sign we finally chose for the cover was confirmed by the administrators of the artist's estate to be genuine. There is an endless number of such stories that document the closely interconnected webs of art that is sold at ever higher prices and crime that is increasingly sophisticated. To tell all these tales without any gaps is neither possible nor the purpose of this book. We're more concerned with spotlighting the structural dangers that arise in a market in which art is no longer art, but rather a vehicle for speculative investment. Independent of the question of guilt, all the cases we document are symptomatic of the thoroughgoing change in the global art market, in which new forms of fraud, misappropriation, and money laundering can thrive so well. People with a lot of money want to have even more money by investing in art, the artist Daniel Richter once said in an interview, describing this social change. The beauty of art, the search for truth, the interrogation of the pictures, liberating laughter, utopias, that's all not taking place. Instead of reversing the structures of ownership, they are radicalized. Many gallerists and art dealers try to keep pace with the booming art market, taking on debt for the purchase or lending of works. These participants are adapting to the changing system in the market, the practice known as flipping, in which objects are resold within a short time frame. In this regard, the art market can compare with the securities exchanges and their commodities, futures, and put options. But what in an earlier era might have been a weekend trip to Luxembourg to slip into a discreet bank back room and clip the coupons on securities acquired with dirty money is today mirrored in visits to the almost completely unregulated free ports in Basel, Zurich, Liechtenstein, and Singapore. Such deals are especially profitable when the transactions are leveraged. A fictive example: for the purchase of an artwork at a price of $1 million, the buyer puts down only $100,000 himself, while agreeing to pay the remainder of the sales price to the seller at a later date. Then the buyer in turn resells the work in the shortest possible time for $1.2 million and straightaway pays the original owner the $900,000 still owed. For a quick return on an investment of $100,000, $200,000 remain. A fantastic return on an investment of 200%. Many of the investors and service providers that have flooded into the art market in the past few years have dreamed of business such as this. These leveraged transactions are even riskier in the art market than in the finance industry in general. If there's a conservation problem or a question about rightful ownership concerning the artwork that is the subject of the transaction, or a sudden change in taste or a market crash that reduces demand, mountains of debt can accumulate in no time. It's often forgotten that most of the participants in the art market continue to pursue their professional life or their interest in collecting honestly and legally. The forgery, fraud, money laundering, and corruption cases are so spectacular, the size of the material and monetary losses so staggering, that these stories spread like lightning around the world in the digital age. The retrogressive lobbying work by the industry, on the pretense of tradition, customary rights, and maintaining the status quo, doesn't help. Only regulations that seek to be fair to all participants can address the new challenges. Stock and commodity exchanges and government regulators oversee the international financial markets, and strict laws and rules are enforced in securities transactions. Service providers and participants are required to disclose conflicts of interest. Insider trading is forbidden. The art market is still, by and large, completely unregulated. Here, precise and complex agreements are not required for million-dollar deals. Here, apart from generally applicable laws, there's no particular oversight of the market. The new narrative of art is that of gigantic profits, as the critic Georg Zeislin diagnosed the problem in an interview in his publication Money Eats Art, Art Eats Money. The question, what is art, is increasingly only answered in dollars. Money has exerted a defining power over art. That is how art is lost to the very people who really need it, to experience a bit of happiness. 10 Questions for the Liberation of Art. How can art be regained as a joyful experience that extends consciousness and offers aesthetic pleasure? How can art be freed from the singular compulsion to make it the most profitable and tax-favorable financial investment? And the related question, how can the increasing infiltration of the art market by criminality be stopped? Scholarship by rigorous, independent art historians must be supported. Experts and the art market must be regulated. Dealers and auction houses should be required to hold on to works that are suspect with respect to their authenticity or provenance, and to notify the authorities about their suspicions. Forgeries should be permanently entered into a database as soon as they appear, and the data banks should be run by independent public institutions, not, as is the case today, by private companies in which the art trade is also a financial investor. Where such a database exists, UNESCO, in collaboration with Interpol, could serve as the institutional operator. This would forestall national organizations, such as lostart.de, funded by Germany at the federal and state levels, which not only is loosely and improperly run, but failed in the past to do its job when suspicious works were supposed to be deleted because of commercial interests. The only way that art can be saved in the long run from the forgers and fraudsters is to have such databases run by truly independent, honest, inviolable institutions. Whenever new regulations are to be introduced, the economically and politically influential organizations of dealers and collectors regularly attempt to thwart change with noisy, exaggerated propaganda. For example, they fought against the law for the protection of cultural goods that went into effect in August 2016 in Germany, which, as with the EU strictures on money laundering, merely enacted the requirements as national laws. In particular, it was the new due diligence duties that drove the dealers to the barricades, because now they would even have to document the names of the seller and the buyer and keep the information for 30 years. Numerous cases of forgery would have been solved sooner and with greater precision had this duty of documentation been required earlier. Successful dealers retain their business records for a long time anyway, since the knowledge of where artworks can be found in the market can be valuable for future business. Even still, dealers and collectors are fighting vehemently against such binding new rules, and not just with opinion pieces or letters to the editor. They have founded the Federation for the Protection of Culture with the expressed goal to coordinate objections to the planned law for the protection of cultural goods and thereby lend them the appropriate gravity, as summarized in a February 2016 solicitation letter that requested financial support for paying a lawyer. An industry group had already paid out tens of thousands of euros, the two-page letter explained, to establish its position with respect to the law. This lawyer, who was working on behalf of the lobbying group, went public and appeared in the media as a quasi-independent expert on issues such as the law for the protection of cultural goods and the regulations on money laundering, arguing the industry's angle against oversight. It's precisely such regulations as formulated in the law for the protection of cultural goods and the new money laundering strictures that could help protect the art market and its lucrative business against thieves, fraudsters, and forgers. Much would be gained if everyone involved in the art market, dealers, collectors, and intermediaries, asked the following 10 questions before each transaction. Can I verify with absolute certainty the provenance of the work of art or cultural asset that is being offered to me? Is the price of the work offered significantly below the usual market price? Can I verify the identity of the seller or buyer? In transactions involving intermediaries or art advisors, who are the true owners of the art and who is the beneficiary of the transaction? Is the source of the money being paid transparent, and can the transfers be traced, which is not true of transactions involving cash, cryptocurrencies, and online payment systems? Have independent, recognized experts and scholars confirmed the authenticity of the works being offered? Does the cultural asset come from an area in crisis or at war? Does the cultural asset have the required and valid export license from its country of origin? Is the provenance of the artwork or cultural asset demonstrably unobjectionable for the time period of the Nazi terror? Is the provenance of the cultural asset demonstrably unobjectionable during the colonial period of the country of origin? Anyone who asks these questions while buying, dealing in, or exhibiting art and antiquities, and who, in doing so, has doubts, should do more research. Inquiry into the provenance often elicits stories that make the work more interesting, more meaningful, and therefore more valuable. Above all else, those artists, gallerists, curators, and auctioneers who operate cleanly and foster transparency and are still focused on art itself, its beauty, its critical power, and its humor, should be much more robustly supported and celebrated. They are, as always, the majority.